Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 2nd, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we start the new year off with a fun experiment. Homebrewing buddies Brooke Baber and Dave Bowder wound up with a bunch of free granola bars. So what did they do? Well, they made beer with them, of course. Brooke and Dave designed an elaborate 9-beer series, not only testing different flavors of granola bars, but different adjuncts in there, too. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place for fine podcasts served up. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And many, many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access as if you sign up as a supporter. And that list grows every month. And again, thanks to everybody for carrying us into 2020 with your support financially. I'm starting off 2020 with remnants of a virus. So if I sound a little stopped up, I apologize. I hope that your new year will be terrific and full of fun and delicious things. And speaking of delicious things, you may remember the beers that Steve and I tasted on the last show of last year, the Disaster Show. Scott and Luciano from Fort Lauderdale sent us some tasty homebrew to sip on, including a honey ginger saison that we were quite fond of. Well, after I posted the show, I got this note from Scott. Scott says, on Monday, December 9th, I went into the kitchen before work, 6 a.m. I noticed a delicious smell of beer. I went around the corner to my laundry room / brewery, and 5.5 gallons of our next batch of honey ginger saison was everywhere. The plastic spigot had simply broken on the bottom of the plastic carboy the beer had been resting in peacefully for 2 months, and we were about to bottle in 2 or 3 days. Scott says, I quickly cleaned up and went to work. Luckily, I keep a lot of old towels around, and they caught most of the liquid. I wrote the company, and they immediately, with no questions asked, sent me a new carboy, no spigot, per my request. Scott says, on the plus side, the smaller fermenter was fine, and I bottled a full case last week. So, jokingly and sarcastically, thanks a lot for including us on the Disaster Show and cursing a beer that you drank on said show. Well, there you have it. A warning for future contributors. We're sorry about that, Scott. Even by association with the Disaster Show, there was a ripple effect. A ripple effect that went backwards in time because, you know, the accident happened after or before the Disaster Show was recorded. So anyway, it was sort of the TARDIS of, of Disaster Shows there. Speaking of the Disaster Show, I sent out most of the prizes for the authors of the Disaster Show story letters a couple of weeks ago, but there are still 4 that I haven't sent out because I don't have addresses to send them to. So if you heard your letter read on the Disaster Show and haven't heard from me asking for your mailing address, check your inbox, your junk inbox, for my letter asking for you to mail your or for your mailing address. Or, better yet, just email me your mailing address to james@basicbrewing.com and I'll get your prize package to you, sponsored by High Gravity and Imperial Organic Yeast. Speaking of which, Casey from Imperial Organic Yeast says there's a new seasonal strain available until the end of February. It's L09 Que Bueno. Que Bueno creates refreshing light-to-dark lagers with very clean, low-ester aromatic profiles and nice, crisp, and dry finishes. Casey says, this strain is not just a great choice for Mexican lagers, but any lager where clean ester profile and dry finish is appropriate. She says, Que Bueno is excellent for brewing Mexican lagers, Vienna lagers, Maibock, and more. And this is lagering season, you know, up here in the Northern Hemisphere. We love Imperial Organic Yeast. My stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore for 5-gallon batches of moderate gravity beers. Imperial has the highest pitch rate, 200 billion cells, and Imperial yeast has a recommended shelf life now of 4 months. I can't wait to try L09 Que Bueno. Look for it at your local homebrew shop from Imperial Organic Yeast. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Darren from Hillard, Ohio writes, I was inspired by your small batch brews, especially the fruitcake barley wine, and thought I might try my own. I've made fruitcake in the past using Alton Brown's free-range fruitcake recipe, which is really good, more like fruit bread, Darren says. I combined your barley wine recipe with some of the fruits from Alton Brown's recipe for my own take. Rather than candied fruit, the recipe uses dried fruit rehydrated in rum. I opted for bourbon, Darren says. Brewed and fermented, it is now sitting for a while in secondary. This started big at 1.117 and settled out at 1030. Whew! I plan on bottling sometime in January and putting it aside until fall. Wow, that's a big beer. Sounds tasty, with the fruit rehydrated in bourbon. It's been a while since I've made a barley wine. And I got a comment on YouTube the other day from somebody who misses the end of the year barley wine series. And I guess I do too. We did, every year there, for a stretch, we did end-of-the-year barley wines. But maybe 2020 is the time to get back into that. Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa want to ring in 2020 with a special just for Basic Brewing Radio listeners. So listen up, 20% off beer and wine kits through January. You got to use the code BB20N20JAN on highgravitybrew.com. when you buy beer and wine kits, but you can save 20%. That's a great deal. High Gravity has a ton of beer and wine kits, and you can tailor the beer kits for your preferences, you know, extract or all grain, crushed or whole grain, liquid or dry yeast, although you know where I would go there. And on the wine side, highgravitybrew.com has basic to super fancy kits. And if you drink wine on a regular basis or, you know, serve it to your non-beer-loving friends who like wine, you owe it to yourself to make your own. It's super easy if you brew beer already, and you save a lot of money by making your own kits. And if you use the code BB20N20JAN during the month of January, you'll save 20% more. High Gravity is the place to go for electric brewing gear, and they have a ton of excellent beer and wine kits. Check them out at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com and use the code BB20IN20JAN, that's BB20N20JAN, to save 20% on beer and wine kits this month at highgravitybrew.com. Okay, this is a great show to start off 2020. These guys have been on the show before. And I love their spirit of, you know, experimentation and innovation. And here they've taken a kind of a goofy idea of brewing with, you know, found granola bars, but they've added a twist to test different approaches to adding different flavors to their sample beers. Brooke Baber and Dave Bowder, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hi, James. Thanks for having us again.
Hello now, again.
Now, Brooke, you were on more recently than Dave with the flour experiment, the flour brewing experiment. But Dave, you were on the show way back when, and I would hate to hazard a guess how many years ago it was, but with the graph experiment.
Yeah, that was, I don't know, 3 years ago, I think, about.
At least.
Yeah, like 2013 something.
Or maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it was that far ago. Wow, 6 years maybe?
Yeah, I looked back, and according to my Skype account, Dave or Brooke, our conversation on the flower beers happened in September of 2018. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Oh, that's crazy.
That's time right about when you got a stash of granola bars to play with.
Yeah, the other day I walked out on my porch and there was a 40-pound banana box full of beers, and no note whatsoever as to who it was, what they were, and who it was from.
Sorry, that's my bad. I just kind of get it in the mail and figure, oh, I'll email them by the time it gets there, and you know, it's that time of year, and you kind of get away from things with work, and so that's my fault.
Well, no, it's more common than you'd think. I get anonymous beers. They just show up, and I'm like, well, I guess somebody will contact me.
The good life you have.
Yeah, well, you know, surprise beers. It's always fun. So and you sent me like three each of these nine batches of beer. So, you know, we had redundancies there. So talk to me about what we're getting into. I mean, you know, we did fruit beers with the Graf, and we did, you know, brewing with flour with the flour experiment. And now what the heck have we gotten into here?
Well, the basics was, you know, Brooke got himself a hold of a whole ton of Nature Valley granola bars, and we just figured we'd try to do something with them and see what the different ones taste like, you know, things like that.
You always hear about people doing these kind of things, but you never really get to taste the results. Or when you do, it's kind of as a, you know, a finished product. And unless you're going through the, you know, how do you really know what it's going to taste like when you ferment a granola bar or bread flour or whatever?
Yeah, I've fermented breakfast cereals. You know, the right. Monster cereals and such, but you know, not a granola bar. But you would think, I mean, they got grain in there. They ought to ferment.
Well, every, you know, as we've learned on Basic Brewing Radio, human beings, we eat amylose and amylopectin. Those are the starches we have the ability to break down. So really, all our foods, no matter if it's breakfast cereal or what have you, when it comes down to it, it's amylose, amylopectin.
So was there a base recipe that you guys started out with?
Yeah, I mean, we basically, when we did the granola bars, we did about, it was 2 pounds of 6-row, and then it was, the granola bars come 2 per pack, so we did 11 and a half packages of granola bars.
That way we could eat one.
yeah, and then we just used USO5 the whole time for our yeast, and then just a 1/2 ounce of Cascade in for hops.
And these are all basically 30-minute boils. So as we learned from Basic Brewing Radio, it doesn't take, you know, a full hour necessarily. And as our standard procedure, these all passed iodine test after mashing.
Ah. And what was the size of the batches?
They were 2.5 gallons.
Oh.
Yeah, so pretty small batches. So we could bust them, you know, so we can do a couple of them a day just to get them all done pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And we use the method we've talked about before where we take part of our water, freeze it in a sterile condition. That way we can take boiling wort at a higher concentration, dump it right onto the frozen sterilized water or fruit juice or what have you, and instantly chill it and ready for pitching.
So how did you handle the granola bars?
I have a food processor, and we just opened the granola bars, threw them in the food processor, and chopped them up really good. I mean, we didn't, like, grind them down to flour or anything like that. We just kind of chopped them up really good, broke them up really well, and then just threw them in with everything else.
So it was a standard mash, basically, with the 6-row?
Right, yeah. We did. It was a brew in the bag is how we pretty much always mash that way nowadays. And so, yeah, it was a brew in the bag mash.
So just a standard 1 hour mash at, say, around, I'm guessing, 65°C or 150 Fahrenheit, something like that?
Yeah, I think we stayed a little under 150.
We do, usually, based on variance, it'll be anywhere from 140 to 145 to 150 is usually where we're sitting.
And how did the efficiency of that mash come out? I mean, you know, did you get about the same gravity that you would expect out of, say, the same weight of, you know, standard brewing grain?
Well, usually for that kind of information, what we'll do is go into samples and kind of get an approximation of what we think we're going to hit. And then when we go to actually make the beer, we'll see what our gravities were. So coming out at 1040 was kind of our rough average on all the base beers. That was right about what we were expecting, you know, given a consummate amount of not necessarily, you know, It's kind of in between when I used flour. It's more like dry malt extract, you know, those kind of quicker gravity that you'll get by weight. But it's more like using actual grain, just maybe a little more efficient.
And Brooke, you've got a culinary background, and I can't remember where you come from, Dave.
Oh, I'm IT. I'm a nerd.
Let's face it, we're all nerds on this conversation.
Yeah. Got our nerd cards come from the dork side. Yep.
Now the as I said, we've got three different groups of beers, and within those three groups, there were three different approaches. So
Right.
can you guys kind of run down what those three groups were, and maybe, I guess, when we get into talking about each group, we can talk about how those broke out, but what are the three major categories?
So that was the major categories were the granola bars. There was an oats and honey granola bar. There was a dark chocolate and oats granola bar, and then the other one was a peanut butter granola bar. So we just made three beers with each of them as the base, and then came up with some generic, you know, some ideas for the other two beers with them.
Basically, the idea is you taste it in the base beer to see what the ingredient actually is to kind of get a better feel for it, and then you can see how it, you know, does it play well with others when you introduce it to other kind of more foreign ingredients.
And in some of the groups, you kind of stayed close to the original ingredient, and then others you kind of took a left or right turn depending on where you were.
It's culinary license.
So I guess one main question that the listeners might be asking themselves out there. I mean, you came upon these granola bars for free. So, normally it would not be the most cost effective probably to brew a batch of beer with the granola bars. But is this just a lark, or is there a sort of quote unquote real reason to be doing experiments like this?
Well, I think the real reason is the same reason most any of us end up picking up that mash paddle. It's to satisfy curiosity, it's to expand your knowledge base. One thing about, you know, cooking is you really don't know what something's like until you taste it, you work with it, you try it. It's the same thing with brewing. You really don't know. You can read about all the hops in the world, but until you see these hop stands and you hear about these hop stands, you know, people actually isolating them and doing that great work on Basic Brewing Radio, we don't actually know that much more about the ingredient and as it stands on its own. So it's more the idea we see a lot of people marketing beers with, you know, baked products, marketing beers with things added to it. I won't say who, but you know, let's say we'll call them Cat Dolphin Brewing, put out a granola bar beer, and I tasted it at work, and I'm like, okay, is there granola in this or what? And they just saying it, like, how do I know it's really in there? So that ended up being kind of the impetus for, you know, we see people say that this is in the beer, but do we really taste it? Does it really add anything? Do you actually pick it up once we start adding other ingredients?
So what I did was I tasted the first batch we're going to talk about on my own, and then I took the second batch we're going to talk about over to Steve Wilkes at stevesbrewshop.com, and then in front of me I've got unopened the third batch. So first off, let's talk about the chocolate granola bars.
I like these.
On the first one, it's 2 pounds of 6-row, 11.5 packages of chocolate granola bars, US05, half an ounce of Cascade, original gravity 1040, finishing gravity 1010, and then carbonated with carb tabs. I tasted this, and my first thought was I wrote down Pilsner-esque. It was very drinkable, and it didn't taste like a weird beer at all. It was nicely balanced with the hop character. It was crisp, had a nice grain flavor. But I was surprised that on my palate, with that just the chocolate granola bars in there, I didn't get a ton of chocolate. How about you guys?
I mean, all three of the base beers with just, you know, where we didn't add any extra ingredients, they all, to me, they tasted kind of similar. But yeah, you didn't pick up very much of the chocolate flavor from the granola bars at all.
But I did. But there was a nice grain character, and I don't know that I would have pegged it as granola, you know, if you hadn't told me. But there was a nice sort of whole grain character to it.
Well, and I think that really comes down to the granola bars itself are basically the same things we're using for brewing. It's just that when they're, you know, malted and they're using it, it's really all about flavor, not necessarily about diastatic properties. So it seems like the real variations in the base beers comes in the subtle, really esters that are produced, because there's not, you know, it's interactions of organic acids and alcohol. So it's very, very subtle. I wouldn't even call it fruitiness, but yeah, it's very, very subtle variation in the base beer at best.
And the second one I tasted was with the Tumaco cocoa powder. Talk about that beer.
There's basically the Tumaco is one region in Colombia, so it's a single source chocolate. The idea is with chocolates, you really kind of taste the terroir of where they're from when they're not blended. Most of the time, whenever you buy a chocolate, it is blended to kind of round out the flavor characteristics. But this in particular is a bar from Colombia, and it's only one particular type of chocolate. Same thing with the cocoa and the bar. I ran a bakery for many years, and I'm a chocolatier also, so kind of the training is I have this just kind of stuff just laying around, so this is kind of what I use to make chocolate at home, so I figured we'd use them to make beer.
And so you added the cocoa powder to this the base beer. How did you get the cocoa? How did you get the cocoa powder in there?
Basically, by making whenever we're kind of doing any kind of emulsification with water, be it cornstarch, whatever. Basically, by making a slurry with it. So I took a little bit of the hot wort, mixed it with the cocoa powder, so we got it nice and smooth. Then reintroduced it to the warm wort.
And it's 4 ounces of the cocoa powder.
Correct.
Now, when I tasted this one, my notes say that there was a cocoa powder flavor right up front. I mean, I got it. It was just like, oh, yep, that tastes like cocoa powder. Again, there was that nice light granola in the background. All three of these beers in this were light colored. There was a chocolatey, and I called it sort of a. Almost an artificial aftertaste to this one. So on the front end of the taste, I got cocoa powder, but it, you know, after I sipped it and swallowed it, it was like, not as tasty, not as drinkable. The first beer was very drinkable. The second one was like, you know, not so much. How about you guys?
Oh yeah, we're sampling along with you, and the cocoa powder definitely does leave a noticeable. It is very pleasant up front, but I think. Were I to build a further beer on cocoa powder, I would try to deal with that aftertaste issue, maybe by incorporating cinnamon or something that's going to linger on the palate better than that's going to be kind of a subtle back flavor. But yeah, I completely agree with you.
Now, the third one in this round was the same base beer with 4.8 ounces of Tumaco 85% chocolate bar in a wort ganache. Now, I'm not a chef. What do we got there?
Well, it's the same basic idea. Whenever you need to incorporate something that doesn't actually dissolve in water, you can forcibly superhydrate it in kind of a basically a quick mixture. So you just take your chocolate, add enough hot wort to it, stir quickly. Once it becomes smooth, you can then reintroduce it into the overall wort. And it won't clump up. You know, all the molecules at that point are perfectly hydrated, so they're not going to clump back up on you.
And does temperature matter when you're trying to integrate something like that?
84 degrees is really the magic temperature of chocolate. It changes state at 84. So if you can just get it up to 84, it will incorporate with a hot liquid, no problem. The real issue is if you take it well beyond that temperature, it burns pretty easy. One little... If anyone's a cook out there and wants to know, if you want to cheat next time and not have to temper your chocolate, just keep it between 84 and 91, and it won't change chemical structure. You can just use it for tempering chocolate.
Now, is that Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Oh, Fahrenheit. Sorry. Trained in America. Fahrenheit.
Now this one, I wrote down crisp again, light, balanced chocolate aftertaste. So in this one, the kind of chemicaliness or artificialiness of the cocoa powder was replaced with more of a sort of an authentic chocolate flavor.
It reminded me of Yoo-hoo, really. It was a nice boozy Yoo-hoo.
Boozy Yoo-hoo.
Boozy Yoo-hoo.
That was my username on America Online.
Now, well,
So out of the three, I would find the first one, the base one, very drinkable, and the third one with the chocolate bar, very drinkable. The second one needs work, but that's what experimentation is all about.
Exactly.
Right.
We wouldn't know any of this if we didn't take time to screw around with it. And that, as we learned from Basic Brewing Radio, that's really, most of the reward of doing these experiments is, well, now you know. And if you decide you want to make something out of it and do something more complex, you have the actual base knowledge. You have the flavor memory to work from.
Now, so was there anything weird with the fermentation with, adding the cocoa powder or adding the chocolate? Did you have to make any kind of adjustments or deal with any kind of a mess?
I'll let Dave take this one. We fermented at his house, so he babysits him.
Yeah. But no, I didn't really notice anything different. When we get to the peanut butter one, there was a little bit. It let off a little bit more esters or some smells when it was fermenting. But these, pretty much all of them is a real simple, easy fermentation.
Hmm. Nice. Now, I took the second batch that we're going to talk about is honey and oat granola bars. And you did a base beer, again, similar recipe. And then in the second one, you added honey malt, 2 pounds of honey malt. And then on the third one, you added honey malt and honey and coconut.
And coconut, yep.
So let's go to Steve's Brew Shop, where he was a busy man and was able to take 5 minutes out to talk to us. But he had one customer in the back, milling grain. So he stole away for a couple of minutes. And we sat down and tasted these beers and talked about them. Well, Steve Wilkes, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks, James.
We're here at in your office at stevesbrewshop.com, and we're tasting granola beers.
Yeah, it reminds me of our old series, Will It Brew?
Well, Brooke has Brooke and Dave has sent us beers in the past, and they were tasty. Yeah. And so it's fun to taste this other experiment, and we're tasting a third of it. And this one has to do with honey and oat granola bars. So the first one is just honey and oat granola bars. The second one has honey malt added. And then the third one has honey malt, and coconut added. So what are your general impressions of the three beers?
They are not bad. The fermentations are nice. They're nice and clean. They're not finished beers. They're not beers that I would say serve at a party. Mm-hmm. But I can definitely taste granola in the beers. I do get a sense of kind of a cracker. I like granola, and the taste of it is familiar to me, and I can taste familiar. It's familiar.
In the words of Andy Griffith.
That's right. So they're kind of nice. The number one is just really light. It has the least character, I guess. It's the least pronounced of the three. Mm-hmm. The second beer is a little bit more character. It's a little fuller flavored. And then the third one with the honey and the coconuts, really quite nice. And it's really a braggot, a coconut braggot in a way.
Yeah. For me, the first one, I had the opportunity to do I tasted a couple of the chocolate granola bars earlier. And this one, I do taste a bit of the granola. It's not super strong, but there is kind of a crackery, I think, is a good adjective. But then there's also a sweetness that I didn't get in the chocolate one that I'm going to attribute to the honey character of the granola bars.
Yeah. So what's interesting about the experiment, I would assume that brewing with granola bars in and of themselves would be rather expensive. Yeah. Unless somebody happens to give you a few cases left over from Hurricane Maria, you know, didn't make it on the truck. But granola, that maybe you live near a co-op like we do, and mm-hmm. you could buy granola mm-hmm. That's maybe organic and doesn't have any additives in it. Might be a really nice brewing adjunct. Instead of, say, flaked wheat or flaked barley, mm-hmm. add a couple of pounds of flaked granola.
Yeah. Now, the first one, we didn't talk about the appearance. The first one is a very light, like hay color, I would say. Mm-hmm. The second one is more of an orange character.
Yeah.
In the color. And then the third one is a shade darker than that, mm-hmm. That adds sort of a copper color to it. The second one with the honey malt added along with the honey and oat granola bars, it's close to the first one in flavor. It's a little bit sweeter on my palate.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. It's interesting. The number three, well, the honey just comes through so nicely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's by far the most interesting. Yeah. Of the three.
Yeah, number three is definitely my favorite. It's got the coconut is kind of an afterthought
on
my palate. It's not like boom coconut. It's you taste it and then at the end of it it's like, oh, what is that? And I told you, and you said, oh, I'm tasting something, and I said coconut, and you said, oh yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure that it adds that much actually after I've had a little bit of it, mm-hmm. meaning that the honey is so nice, and the general impression of the beverage is nice, and the coconut almost puts a kind of a woody flavor to it.
Huh.
That it isn't objectionable, but I'm not sure it complements it that well.
Mm. I can see that. The character of the honey is so strong.
Yeah.
That it really overshadows the other flavors. It's good. I like the. I don't know what kind of honey it is, but it is very nice. And like I say, it's my favorite. So there you go. We hear the doorbell. So thank you, Steve.
Thank you, James. Time to soldier on.
So again, with that base beer, we liked it. It's very drinkable and had, you know, kind of that granola flavor. But, you know, it wasn't odd in any way. And then with the honey malt, you know, that added a layer of complexity to it. But then the one we fell in love with was the one with the honey, you know, and that's more of a braggot. And it kind of, you know, that's a different ball game.
Yeah, that one was a little bit more like tried to actually make a beer instead of just throwing stuff together. I gave that one to a couple of people at work too, and they love that beer too. So you're not alone in that one.
And really, that one's just Dave's recipe for what he eats in the morning on his breakfast. So he uses honey and coconut on oats. So we're like, all right, honey and coconut oat beer. Here we come.
So again, was there any difference in fermenting or working with the honey and oat granola bars over the chocolate ones?
Well, we did one thing a little different in that we split the coconut, and half of it went, you know, into the same grinding procedure, went right into the mash with everything else, and half of it,
yeah, the other half we dry hopped for, I think it ended up being about 8 or 9 days because I put it in a little late and then we didn't get to bottle it right away. So it ended up being 8 or 9 days for the dry hop, or dry coconut, if you will.
And in that one, I don't know if we said, but 2 pounds of honey malt, 3 pounds of honey, 2 pounds of coconut, 1 pound going in the mash, and 1 pound going into the dry hop. Looking at the recipe, I would have thought that you would get more of that coconut flavor, but maybe it was just the flavor of the honey that just overpowered everything.
Well, and it is competing with. One of the things we find that we use in a lot of our, you know, finished beers, one of our favorite products is honey malt. It adds a lot of character. And yeah, the honey we used was a clover honey from Trader Joe's. So it's a good quality honey. I eat it quite a bit. So it does pack a lot of flavor too, which is nice. It's not an overwhelming flavor like a flower honey, but it makes a very noticeable flavor when you use it.
Okay. Now, here's the moment of truth here. Here we have the unopened beers, and I haven't sampled these. I haven't cheated. But we've got the peanut butter granola bars. So again, it's the same recipe for the base beer. And let's see, it says the gold cap. So I've got the gold cap here, and you've assured me that I'm not in risk of spraying.
We'll open ours first.
Well, too late on this one.
Oh, okay.
I'm pouring it, and it's a nice golden color, nicely carbonated. Yeah. Not a whole lot of head on this one.
Yeah, we only used I think two or three carb tabs for each bottle, so it was fairly low carbonation.
Three carb tabs on the gold bottle.
And cheers, gentlemen. This is the peanut butter granola bar. It's tasty. There's some esters in there. It's kind of fruity. And I'm searching for the peanut butter.
Yeah, I didn't taste any peanut butter. I mean, I don't have the best tongue in the world, but the main thing that surprised me with that beer was the smell and just the fruity esters of it. That jumped out at me right away, and I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, it is pretty fruity. It's drinkable. I think it's a good beer. But
and I think that's really just what happens. I mean, how often do you really see any kind of peanut product get fermented or nut products in general? So, and I think when I was in France, I did have a hazelnut beer once, and it depending on how it's used, they can add a ton of character.
Now, I have had beers made with the dried peanut butter stuff, you know, and you can get some peanut or peanut butter character, you know, using that.
Yeah, that's a little concentrated, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about that. I have some of that here. We should have tried that, too. Oh, well, thanks for the idea.
Oh, great. Now we're at it again. We have more granola bars, so.
Yeah. Now, maybe I'm talking myself into it, but I don't know. There might be a tiny bit of peanut butter in there.
Well, when you look at the composition of the granola bar, too, like if you're making granola as a baker, peanut butter really is a binder and a flavoring agent, but most of the body of that recipe is going to be your grain product.
Mm-hmm.
My baking instructor was from Holland, and he taught us all of our recipes as percentages of the flour used. So whenever you learned a recipe, you didn't learn measurements, you learned percentages. And the 100, you know, the full amount, was always how much flour in the recipe. So when it comes to making something like a granola bar, peanut butter's got flavor, it's a binder, but it's still, when it comes down to it, we're just talking about, you know, amylose and amylopectin, and most of that's fermentable. And that process, when it interacts with the peanut flour, is going to determine that little subtle character, you know, difference in flavor.
Now, one reason why you would maybe not want to use peanut butter as opposed to the dried stuff is that, you know, there's a lot of oil in peanut butter, and that would interfere with head retention. And there's not really, well, there's no head on this one. And I don't know if that has, you know, anything to do with that or not, but.
Right. Peanut flour is typically defatted. So it's pressed to the point where it's just the peanut protein and peanut carbohydrate, and the fat's largely gone. Whereas, you know, you'll see further in the experiment, we did use a straight up nut meal. And that's a little different in that you're going to have full incorporation of all the products that would go into, like you said, a butter.
Okay. So number one, the base beer is nice and drinkable. But you know, it's not peanut buttery. It's not, you know, Captain Crunch, you know, peanut butter cereal, which I used to eat right out of the box when I was a kid.
And, dominant character we got was kind of a, compared to the other two, especially, we picked up kind of a more fruity characteristic.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's dangerous to eat Cap'n Crunch peanut butter cereal dry because the roof of your mouth will just be wrecked. So,
yeah.
Got to cover it in chocolate sauce.
Okay, we've got the second one, which is 11 and a half. There's 2 pounds of 6-row, 11 and a half packages of peanut butter granola bar, 6 pounds of watermelon, 4.5 pounds of cherries, and then the 1/2 ounce of Cascade, The original gravity on this one is 1060. So, and then the finishing gravity was a little lower at 1.0065. So, were you trying for like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich here?
That's basically the idea. Yeah, I'm kind of a prolific gardener. I have a problem, so I produced a bunch of little hanging melons, watermelons that were about, you know, the size of a softball, and it was, you know, just more than we could eat. So I skinned them, froze them, and said, okay, this will break down the flesh when we need to make a nice beer. So I just basically tossed them in a double muslin brew in the bag, and it went from this giant thing down to this little tiny bag of pulp we could just pick out and remove. And then I happened to have a bunch of cherries left over from another little thing I made. So it was, you know, basically peanut butter and jelly. You basically nailed it, James. Thank you.
Now, this one has a definite pinkish hue. It's definitely looks different from the first one. And the smell, you can really smell fruit in this one.
It's definitely got some wine characteristics. It's almost like a rosé meets a beer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Steve and I did a watermelon beer where all of the brewing water in the beer was watermelon juice. And it came out pretty weird.
Yay!
But all the red went away in that one. But the pinkish hue is definitely in this one. How did you handle the fruit?
Well, like I said, we took the watermelons. They had been in my freezer from last harvest, so they'd already been skinned. So I just took and put them in a brew in a bag and dumped them right in with the mash. And then the cherries, I did the exact same thing. I took a brew in a bag, muslin, doubled it, and dumped the cherries right in, tossed them right in the mash, and literally just mashed away with everything else. And, you know, just like everything else, put a double knot in it and beat the tar out of that bag. So by the time it was done, it was just pulp and fiber left in the bag.
Okay.
Yeah. And well, I will say the cherries were frozen. So using Dave's handy dandy food processor, we did process them a little bit just to get them, you know, kind of more of a slushy to go in.
Well, this is interesting. It's, there is that,
better now.
It's, there is kind of I taste the same kind of twang that our watermelon beer had. You know, maybe the cherries is uplifting that a little bit, but you know, after fermentation, the watermelon beer was just kind of odd.
And I think watermelon, when it comes down to it, its flavor, a lot of it is texture, a lot of it is, you know, in the rind itself. That's why when we, you know, when I skinned them, I left most of the rind on because I knew I was going to use them for brewing. So I think when it comes down to, it's a matter, if you're going to brew with it, it's a matter of how much rind. Like, for example, candied watermelon rind is quite tasty because you're packing most of the flavor in the rind itself. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily just be a throwaway product. But I think in this case, since we had it incorporated, it does keep a lot more of that watermelon character. And I think you're totally right. The cherry does definitely give it a little kick, especially in the color department and flavor. They were nice dark cherries. They were dark sweet red cherries.
My grandma used to make pickled watermelon rind with maybe a little, it's hard for me to remember, it's a long time ago, but maybe a little clove in there with it.
If you got a recipe, I'd love it.
Well, unfortunately, she's long gone, and she came over. She was, you know, she came from the Depression era, so, you know, she didn't want to waste anything. So we were eating watermelon at the house one time, and she actually dug the watermelon rinds out of the trash and washed them and took them home and pickled them.
That is a woman after my own heart.
Was it in the trash or on the trash, Grandma?
Well, I mean, that's our culinary heritage right there. A lot of people don't think about it. Like, for example, the hamburger in America, that's culinary heritage, and that comes to us largely out of the Great Depression. You had the slug burger in northern Mississippi for people to get by because it cost only a nickel. You got the smashed burger originally starting in St. Louis all the way up to Illinois. That's because you can make it really cheap by spreading the meat flat on a griddle. So that, you know, that Depression-era cooking, that's our culinary heritage. There's no reason we should lose that stuff.
Yeah. Well, this beer's growing on me, actually. The more I sip, the more I sip on it, the more I'm liking it.
Yeah, I will say, like, we tried it like right after we, well, 2 weeks after we bottled it, and it has aged pretty well. It tastes a lot better now, because I think it's been a couple months now at least. It's a lot better flavors and taste now than what it was when we first tried it.
Yeah, that's the way it was with our watermelon beer. I held on this, you know, because I don't like to just throw stuff out. So I'll hang on to it if it doesn't taste exactly the way I want it, I'll let it sit for a while and give it another chance later. And it did age into something that was more palatable. So
Dave and I have a couple of beers in our cellar we made when we were first brewing that we carbonated them with freeze-dried blueberry and freeze-dried mango. And we found a couple bottles of that, and we're kind of waiting for an occasion to open those.
Now, the peanut butter, I'm getting zero peanut butter in this one, but that's not surprising, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much lost with the fruit. I think you're totally right, and Dave, you both made the right assertion. I think if we wanted more of that, we would need to bring in some of that defatted peanut flour.
Okay, tell me about this third beer that I'm about to open.
Well, this one is more of just something I had always wanted to try, kind of from the James Spencer Willett brew file. I work, around all kinds of different, food products, and I use almond meal and baking and whatnot. And I always look at it, and it's got a good flavor. It lends a nice texture. So why not try it in a beer? Well, obviously, almonds are something like 40% fat. It's a lot of, as we've learned from Basic Brewing Radio, starches come in a lot of forms, and many times they're bound up in these fat molecules or around these fat molecules. Sometimes those are sulfur bonds, sometimes they're, other types of bonding, but the truth is the starches we get that are available are much different than the starches that are present. So like in pulses, for example, peas, legumes, stuff like that, the starches themselves are largely locked up in these fat and protein rings. Well, the same thing with, trying this. I'm looking at this almond meal thinking, okay, how is it going to ferment? Can it get through mashing? Are we just going to have a slick film of fat on top? What's going to happen? So that really is the impetus for trying this.
I'm tasting it, and we're back to closer to the original color. But is it my imagination, or is there a tiny bit of a green tint to the...
And it's... I don't know about you, but mine's sour.
It's sour?
Oh, yeah.
Well, mine is, it smells very fruity.
Taste it.
It's a little tart, but it's not bad.
I'm pretty sure after doing some research, there's two types of ways you can sour a beer. You can do it through biological means, i.e., the use of lactobacillus, Bruxellensis, all these different bugs. Or I think we've come upon a method of chemical souring.
Introducing or lowering the pH chemically. I mean, you can do the same thing with acidulated malt. You can lower the pH. But it's not, it's not like super sour. I'd say it's slightly tart.
It's sauerkraut sour. It's not painfully sour. Like on a hot day, I would totally drink this. Mm-hmm. It's good.
Yeah, and I swear it's nuttier than the first one.
I would tend to agree with you.
Yeah.
But I think my palate, like I said, I kind of have a sensitive palate. I pick up a lot on that little sauerkrauty, and I love it. Don't get me wrong. I love it. But I get that little nice, briny, sharp bite to it.
Mm-hmm. It's more along the lines of like a goza or something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and the nice part is we didn't have to introduce any kind of crazy bugs to our system, and now we know how to make a sour.
That's actually pretty tasty.
This was a surprise beer I was talking about. We did not expect this, but I think the chemical degradation, there's a sulfur bond that's part of basically most of the smells we get in food, most of the smells of terpenes, of flavor compounds, really they have a lot to do with sulfur compounds. So when it comes down to it, it doesn't surprise me that this beer's got a lot of nose. It's got a little sulfur, you know, it's got a little acidic bite to it. It kind of makes sense. I've had almond milk go bad from being, you know, mispackaged when sent. And that definitely has kind of a sour smell to it. So it doesn't surprise me at all that this is what we ended up with.
So the standout beers out of all nine of these, I would say this is a standout beer.
Thank you.
The chocolate bar beer is also a standout, and then of course the honey one. I guess you'd call that a braggot. And then the base beers all were drinkable. But they weren't like wacky, ooh, this tastes like a granola bar. They were just, you know, solid beers. So as an experiment, I think that this is a success.
Well, thank you. Our goal is really just to contribute to that body of knowledge that Basic Brewing Radio has given us. You know, the reason we can do this stuff and we feel comfortable kind of just, you know, saying, hey, can we brew that, is because of what we learned. So if we can give anything back, you know, it's thank you to James, to you, to having this platform for us to give something back and give kind of the results of our experiments back to the community.
Well, I appreciate you guys. I mean, I don't know that I would have had the patience. I certainly wouldn't have invested in buying granola bars.
I've done matzo cracker beers. I've done, you know, for me, it's one of those things where I brew things I can't buy. You know, there's no reason for me to brew it if someone else is already doing it. That's one reason I probably never brewed the same beer twice. It's for me, it's always kind of the fun of experimentation is half the reason I'm doing this, and a chance to hang out with one of my best friends ever. So, you know, it's to me, brewing is nothing but a good investment of my time.
Well, there you go. Well, guys, this has been fun. I appreciate it, and I hope you'll keep me on your contact list for future experiments.
Well, I'll preview right now then. We have another experiment going kind of related to this. Because of the almond beer, I saved the troop from it. I tasted it. I liked it. And I'm letting it kind of stay in the fridge and chill for a little bit. Then I'm going to cheesecloth strain it and turn it into a cold feta or, you know, that kind of hand-packed cheese. And we'll see how it comes out. But I think there's a possibility for using things like, you know, nuts and whatnot in your fermentation. And then that trub is not necessarily devoid of, you know, it's not just yeast cells anymore. There's a lot going on in there. There's protein, there's fats, there's all kinds of healthy stuff. Like in this fermentation, yes, we got a fat layer that rose. We basically bottled out from underneath it. But that trub is actually, I think, very valuable. So I kept it, and my plan is next to probably make it over here in a week or two and go ahead and start the process of making it into cheese. Try it on some brioche or something.
Wow. I would not have thought to go there.
Well, this is part of the problem, James. You've kind of taught me to look at all this stuff as, oh, it's just food. We just happen to make it in liquid form and ferment it. So when I'm looking at all the, you know, stuff we're playing with, there's no reason that this can't, I don't know, give life to another food product.
Another step in the evolution.
Exactly.
Well, Brooke and Dave, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, thank you, James. And again, can't appreciate you enough for providing this platform for us and other homebrewers. It's, how shall I say, the most invaluable tool out there. I tell anybody who asks me about brewing that this is where you want to get started.
Wow. Cheers.
Yep. Yeah, thanks for the time, James.
Well, thanks again to Brooke and Dave. I'm looking forward to hearing about what else comes out of the collaboration. I know somebody, I personally know someone in the granola bar business, and I'm tempted to ask if there are any, you know, free samples lying around that I can play with. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. I'm sick, I tell you. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.